You're listening to the Irish Times Roisin Meets podcast.
Welcome back to Roisin Meets. My guest today has been the top story on news bulletins in print and online for over a week now. She is Limerick woman Vicky Phelan. The story we've been hearing about is that scores of women with cervical cancer were not told that smear test results showing them to be in the clear were in fact inaccurate, and the revised test results were kept from them for years. The controversy arose after Vicky, who's a 43-year-old mother of two with cervical cancer, settled a high court case against a US laboratory that was subcontracted by Cervical Check, the National Cervical Screening Program, to assess the tests. She received a settlement of 2.5 million euro last week without an admission of liability, and her case against the health service executive was struck out. Vicky Phelan only learned about her test results last year. She had a smear test in 2011 after the birth of her second child, and it initially showed no abnormalities. She was diagnosed with cancer in 2014. That same year, an audit of her 2011 test showed that it was not accurate. She's now suffering from terminal cancer, and she was told in January that she has between 6 and 12 months to live. But as you'll hear, Vicky is fighting on and determined for the sake of her husband and her two children to keep as healthy as she can. As she put it herself when all this broke, they fecked with the wrong woman. And here she is. Vicky, thanks very much for coming on the podcast today. Now, you tweeted this morning that heads should roll. Can you tell us where you're at in terms of how things have developed since you walked out of the court 10 days ago?
Yeah, I mean, look, I suppose when I started all of this, obviously I was doing it primarily for myself and my family in the event that I do die. And I mean, I'd like to say just, I suppose, at the top of my head, I really don't think I'm going to die. I mean, some people probably think I'm in denial. I am not in denial. I know I've got a terminal illness, but I mean, I'm going to throw everything at this. And that is the main reason I took this case, was to get the funds to be able to throw everything at my illness to give myself a fighting chance of surviving. So that was the main priority for me when I took this case. And obviously the second priority, if I do die, is to provide for my family. But once my solicitor, found out information that there were other women involved, I mean, I thought it was just me. But when we found out that there were other women involved, there was no way I could have ever sat on that information. Just morally, ethically, I'm a principled person. I certainly couldn't do that. But at the same time, I mean, when I from the very get-go, I was never going to sign a confidentiality clause, because I thought what was done to me, withholding this information for 3 years was absolutely inexcusable. And then I found out that there were other women, and that just made my resolve even stronger, to be honest, to make sure that this would never happen to anybody else. So to go from 14 women to, Jesus, potentially, is it 3,000 at this stage, Roisin?
Yeah.
I'm absolutely, I mean, I just think it's disgraceful. It is a scandal. I mean, the word is being used correctly at this age. It is an absolute scandal. And I suppose I know I should be focusing on my health, but I do find it very difficult to pull back.
Yeah.
Because I know that people are listening to me, because I'm telling the truth. What I speak is the truth, and I seem to be the only one doing that at the moment. So I feel very strongly that if I say something, that people are going to stand up and listen, and at least it might push people up at the top to start making decisions that are the correct decisions.
And can we just go to Tony O'Brien, the fact that you've called for his head? I mean, he's only in the job till, this July, I think. So some people might say, well, that's, it doesn't really matter. But does it matter to you that he should step down?
100%. Absolutely, 100%. I mean, I can't understand how he can have the balls, to be honest, to stay in the job at this stage, because he may only have 12 weeks to ride out this storm and, go off into the sunset, which is big fat pension. But I just think, he should just man up and actually accept that as the head of the HSE, the buck stops with him. How he can, I know he has said he didn't hear about my case until last week, but I don't believe that for one second, to be honest. I mean, a memo was prepared for the Minister for Health. How could it not have been prepared for the HSE, who are being sued in this instance by my solicitors and my case? So I just don't really accept that that can be the case. And also, I mean, bear in mind, he was the head of the National Cancer Control Programme back in 2008 when these smears were outsourced. and went against very good sound scientific advice about the potential for huge deaths and misdiagnoses back in 2008, and he went against that. So, you know, I can't understand how he didn't see that this could potentially happen and keep an eye on it while he was in post over the last number of years.
Okay, well, that's very clear. And you've also been very clear about the fact that Gronie Flannery should have been the one to tell you about it as well. Did you have questions you wanted to ask Gronie Flannery?
I don't actually. I mean, she has stood aside, and I have to say I admire her for that, that she did actually do the right thing. I don't have any questions for her because, I mean, it was all fairly clear in the communications between herself and my gynaecologist how she felt. She had her clinical hat on and she didn't see past the fact that there were women involved in this. I know exactly where she stood on it. She wasn't looking at it with a human eye whatsoever.
Okay. Can we go back to the fact that you had an opportunity to basically shut up about this and maybe take some money and never speak of it again, that non-disclosure agreement that you could have signed but you didn't? What's it like when somebody comes to you and asks you to sort of stay silent? And was there any a moment when you felt, well, maybe I'll go down that road?
It's an unusual situation to be put in because I suppose I have to say after, you know, that I was in a very good position with my case. My solicitors, we had a very airtight case. We knew that. So for me to be able to say no to the non-disclosure agreement was easier probably than some other women who may be taking cases going forward. It was quite clear to my solicitors, to the experts in my case that were called to provide evidence, that my smear was an absolute miss. There was no question but that either it was looked at by somebody who was totally incompetent or it wasn't looked at all. The smear sample itself was so full and plentiful of cancer cells that there is no way it could have been missed. So it was a negligent smear that was missed in my case. So I suppose we knew from kind of not the get-go, but kind of once we started getting all the documents back in to prepare for the case, that I had a very, very good case and that, you know, my solicitor more or less told me he would back his house on me winning. So I had that confidence going in. Roisin, I'm a very principled person. Once I make my mind up about something, I don't really back down. So I totally 100% believed in my solicitors. I had great faith in them. But I also believed that I had a very strong case and I knew we were going to win. And it wasn't about the money so much to me after a certain amount of money. You know, I knew I was going to get a good settlement out of it. So, you know, even if they had offered me 5 million, Roisin, and they didn't, so in case people think they did, even if they had offered me a ridiculous amount of money, I still would never have signed a non-disclosure agreement because there was too much at stake for other women and for the future of the cervical screening program. I have a daughter who's coming up. I mean, there's no way I could put faith in a program for my daughter coming through. So I had to act. That it was as simple as that for me. And I never wavered. I mean, I never at one point worried that I made the wrong decision, to be honest. And the day of the mediation, when this confidentiality clause was put on the table, it actually happened before myself and my husband arrived. We had been getting the train up, and when we arrived into the distillery building, that's where we went for the mediation. When we arrived, Cian O'Carroll came down, my solicitor, and said, look, Vicky, he said, you and Jim, you know, go out for a cup of coffee. He said, there's been a bit of a development. They're looking for a confidentiality clause. And I started straight away kind of going, are you serious? I said, do they not know? Have you not already told them that there is no way I'm signing this? And he said, yeah. He said, we know, don't worry. He said, I just needed to get that from you. He said, your reaction is enough. He said, I know you don't want to sign a non-disclosure agreement. He said, so we're just trying to kind of iron things out up here before you come up. So when I came up then to the room, you know, there were three rooms for the mediation. So me and my solicitors and barristers were in one room. The HSE and the State Claims Agency and their crowd were in another room, and then the lab and their barristers and solicitors were in the third room, and then this mediator was going between the three. And, we were literally, once, you know, we told them absolutely not, there is no way that Vicky will sign a confidentiality clause. We had to sit there until lunchtime, or I think it was nearly 2 o'clock that day, and this was from, about 11 o'clock that morning. until the company, the lab in America, came online, basically, so that their barristers and solicitors could say, well, look, she's not going to sign a confidentiality clause. What do we do now? So, you know, at that stage, they decided, well, this is something that they had written into their contract with the HSE. Mm. If she's not going to sign a confidentiality clause, well, then we just go to trial. And that was it. So we went home that day knowing that the trial was going to start then the following week, the following Thursday. And, I was ready for that, yeah. Roisin. I mean, to be honest, I wasn't one bit worried.
You know what was interesting to me, Vicky, just reading the reports? The fact that the case against the HSE was struck out. And I haven't seen much about that. Can you talk a bit about that? Because obviously maybe it was very clear, like you said, the incompetency or the fact that the smear was missed by the lab. But what has kind of created this scandal or created the kind of national conversation and, you know, a government that's sort of slightly in crisis about it is the fact that people weren't told. But that sort of issue that wasn't enough to do anything in terms of a case against the HSE.
Yeah, the day we settled, so my husband was due to give evidence on the Tuesday. He went up to Dublin on the Tuesday to give evidence. And, you know, Roisin, I mean, people forget behind all of this, you know, there are, you know, we are a family, we're humans, and, you know, we were put through this awful ordeal. That has to be kind of borne in mind, that, you know, this is very, very traumatic for my family, particularly for my husband and for my parents, who, you know, were up at the court and had to listen to me talk about, you know, very private parts of my life and answer questions about, you know, when I died. They were never talking about if, they were always talking about when. And that's very hard to hear. But, so when they decided to offer the settlement, and I think it was basically the gynecologist expert, Professor Shepherd, when he went up on the stand, they literally ran for the hills at that stage, you know, and my solicitor said the barristers were in and out, running literally like headless chickens in and out on the phone while the gynecologist was on the stand, basically kind of saying, well, make this stop, you know, because the gynecological expert was so brilliant and so scathing of what had happened and kept mentioning these 10 other women. And the court reporters were there obviously scribbling all of this down. So they knew it was going to come into the papers and this was going to cause an absolute scandal, you know. So that was when they offered the settlement without the confidentiality clause, because they knew it was going to get worse before it got better, to be honest. And when they did offer the confidentiality clause, the only way that they would offer me a settlement with the confidentiality clause was if the HSE got struck out. Now, I have to say, when my solicitor told me that the HSE were going to be struck out and that the lab was going to pay for all the damages in the settlement, I was furious. I just thought, does this mean they're going to get away with this? Because, you know, I'm not a legal person. So, you know, he had to explain to me what this meant. He said, well, technically, yes, in legal terms, yes, they're not liable for anything, he said. But look, you know, this is a very good case, he said. We know they have done you wrong, he said, and we know that they have withheld information from other women. So, you know, this is going to go in the media, he said, and we're going to push it that way, he said, and make them responsible. So that was the only way I would agree to it, because, to be honest, Roisin, I nearly pushed for, not accepting that a settlement as well, to be honest, because I was so furious that they were going to be struck out.
And I mean, I suppose that's what I'm thinking. Other women, because I presume you've been in touch with them, you're something of a lightning rod now for a beacon, and as well as, obviously, you have to go off and try and mind yourself and try and somehow, you know, get the resources to try and try everything you can to look after yourself. There's women coming to you, I presume, now and looking to know what to do. And I suppose pursuing the HSE is not a thing that case was struck out. It's all about the labs. Is that correct?
Yeah. I have been contacted by at least three women and one man who contacted me yesterday, whose wife is one of the 17, and I'm not going to give too much details because, you know, that's his business. But, you know, he has been in touch with me. His wife was very young. I mean, this is a very upsetting part of it for me, to be honest, you know, to hear all these stories. Like, this woman is only 36. They've got two small boys, and she's only dead since last year. I mean, you know, and this is the part that makes me so angry that, you know, and I did say this already, it's all young women that are involved in this scandal. You know, I mean, I know there are older women as well, probably. But, you know, these are young women with young families leaving very small children behind, and nobody's held accountable. That, you know, it's just disgraceful. And this poor man is here now trying to, you know, take a case against the HSE, and he's still grieving for his wife. I mean, it's just disgraceful.
Yeah, and you're the one who people will come to, and I suppose you're glad to do that on one level.
Oh, absolutely,
but,
yeah. Absolutely. I mean, Roisin, at the moment I'm screening calls, I'm screening messages, because my phone is literally just hopping But you know what I am going through. I mean, and I do appreciate all the messages that I am getting from everybody. It's a bit overwhelming, to be honest, the type of things that people are saying. You know, because I'm a very normal person. You know, I'm being called a national hero, and I'm amazing, and you know, I suppose I am. But I mean, I'm just doing it because it's the right thing to do. I don't really, you know, I never wanted the accolades. I just did it because I just could not stand over not letting those other women know. And I only knew that there were, you know, 14 other women at the time. I never would have imagined that there would have been this many women involved. But what I am doing is I'm screening, you know, going through all the messages that are coming in, and I'm prioritizing anything that's coming from women or from husbands or fathers, you know, of women. And I'm contacting those people as a priority, you know, because I know how hard this is and how difficult it is to go up against these type of people. And I'm giving them as much information as I can, and obviously referring them to my solicitor because he's fantastic. You know, but, you know, they're the people I want to help out in this whole affair.
Yeah. Vicky, can I talk to you a bit about, there's some people talking about how this is kind of has to be put in context in terms of women's health and the treatment of women in Ireland generally over decades. I mean, there's people in the conversation bringing in everything from, you know, mother and baby homes, Magdalene laundries, the hepatitis C, ways that this church and the state in this country has failed women. Do you see it in that context? Do you see it as a gender issue? I just wondered about that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it is, you know, because all of these cases, I mean, because I'm reading the papers every day and trying to keep up with the developments as they're happening, I'm reading about all these other cases that people are referring to. And it's only when you read them and you know, like the hepatitis C scandal and Bridget McCall in Donegal, you know, you just see the and it's the aggressiveness, Roisin, it's the aggressiveness with which these people are pursued by the HSE through the State Claims Agency that is disgraceful. You know, and that's the part of my case, you know, and the way they fought me that I find, you know, very hard to believe. I mean, at the end of the day, none of these people, nor myself, are on trial here. You know, we're the victims. Yet, you know, from my case in particular, and I'm sure all cases, you know, people who have taken these cases against the State Claims Agency have been very similar. You know, you're the one going up there having to answer all these questions. When really it should be the people who are defending the case who should be asked all the questions and made to answer those difficult questions. Yet that never happened in my case. You know, they struck it out before they got to put any of these people up on the stand. You know, I mean, they had Professor Gráinne Flannelly was one of their witnesses, and I was waiting. To be honest, that was half the reason I didn't want to settle, because I wanted them to go up there and answer questions that I wanted answers for. And that never happened, and I think that is disgraceful.
Can we go back a bit? Because you've mentioned the word stubborn quite a few times, and I think people have watched you on TV and heard you on radio. That's why you're so impressive. The fact that you wouldn't let it go, and the fact that you knew you had right on your side, and you were just telling the truth, and you kept on telling it. Can we go back to when you were a kid? Were you like that as a child? Would your mother have said that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm the oldest of five kids, and I was always bossy. You know, I'm a Scorpio. I mean, read up about a Scorpio. I am the epitome of what a Scorpio is. And you don't cross them. You know, I mean, if somebody crosses me, they pay for it, really. You know, I don't forgive very easily, nor do I forget. And I have a memory like an elephant. I mean, that's you know, I'm the type of person who will research anything, and I can make myself an expert on things quite quickly if I can, you know, get my head around it. So I suppose that's why, you know, I mean, I'm absolutely voraciously reading everything I can about not only my trial, but all of the other trials that they're referring to. I'm also reading about all these different types of inquiries so that I can understand the difference, so that I can, you know, make a comment reliably, because I don't want to be going out there and putting up a tweet when I don't understand what I'm saying. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So I suppose that I've always been like that. Do you know, I mean, I'll investigate anything. My daughter was diagnosed with congenital toxoplasmosis when I was pregnant. So that was it. I was off. I started researching all about congenital toxoplasmosis. And I mean, her infectious diseases consultant, Dr. Wendy Ferguson in Temple Street, has been fantastic. I mean, that's one side of the HSE that I have to say I have to commend, is the paediatric side of it. You know, my daughter has had the best of care since she was diagnosed. So I do, you know, I don't want people to think that I'm a total anti-HSE person. I'm not. You know, there are there are parts to the service that work very well, but you know, there are equally parts to it that do not work so well and need to be disbanded. But yeah, I mean, look, I'm just the type of person that when I take something on, I take it on 100%.
And how is Amelia now? That's your daughter.
Yeah, she's good. I mean, we still have issues at the moment. She's actually had to go back on a kind of a higher dose of the maintenance medication she's on at the moment because she's going through puberty and this has triggered a reactivation of her infection. What she has is toxoplasmosis is a parasitic infection. So it's a little parasite that sits literally at the back of her eye. There's no cure for it. This parasite literally goes into a spore and it just sits there. And, you know, it's been dormant literally since, you know, she was treated as a baby. But the problem was once she hit puberty with hormones and everything, it just kicked everything back off again. So she nearly lost her eyesight last summer. You know, we had a lot of appointments, had to take her over to see a specialist in Moorfields Hospital in England, one of the top eye hospitals in the world. And she had to have laser surgery to stop her retina from detaching. So, you know, I mean, people say I'm brave and I'm determined and I'm, you know, inspirational, but they haven't met my daughter, you know. I mean, she's only 12 and she's gone through a lot more than I have in my life. And I'm fighting for her, Roisin, and that's why I'm doing all of this. I don't want my daughter to lose her mother as well as everything else, you know.
Yeah. But you are inspirational. I just have to throw that in. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
You know, you got this 2.5 million settlement now, and you said earlier to me, you know, I don't think I'm going to die, and you're determined to find some kind of treatment that's going to work for you. Mm-hmm. What are you doing? I know you're in Galway at the moment as we speak, and you are doing some kind of therapy. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I just came up to Galway. There's this new clinic that's opened up called Oxy Regeneration. I found out about it from my bioenergy healer. He's called Michael O'Doherty. He's an MS. He's absolutely fantastic. He's literally trying to mind me. He rings me every day to make sure. Now, you need to focus on yourself, Vicky. So he wants to make sure that I'm not going anywhere anytime soon. But he told me about this clinic up here. So I'd read about oxygen, hyperbaric oxygen therapy. So you go into this chamber and you go through compressions and decompressions, and you literally flood your body with a huge amount of oxygen. And, you know, from everything, you know, you read about cancer cells cannot thrive in an oxygenated environment. So to me, it makes sense. And so I started reading articles about this that support it. And if you flood your body with oxygen, you know, it will kill cancer cells. And in my situation, what I'm trying to do at the moment, I know I can't necessarily cure myself. I've got a 10-centimeter tumor, but what I can do is prevent it from spreading. So that's what I'm trying to do with all the different therapies I'm doing. So I'm doing the oxygen therapy up here in Galway. I go to Portlaoise to a clinic for vitamin C infusion. His name is Dr. Gabriel Stewart, and I've been going to him since January. And all of these things are expensive. I mean, the vitamin C therapy is, you know, €300 every time I go there. This oxygen therapy is €120 every time I go. So, I mean, I'm not long going through all my money with all of these type of therapies. And none of it is refunded. And that has to be borne in mind through any type of health insurance, because they're not recognised as therapies that the medical profession will refund, you know.
What do you think about that? I mean, these are things I presume that the sort of the HSE or conventional medics wouldn't necessarily approve of. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, that is fair to say. I mean, you know, they're trying to bring in this anti-quackery bill, which I totally disagree with, to be honest, because they're going to try and rule out all of this type of therapy because they think, you know, these type of therapies are preying on vulnerable people. I'm not a vulnerable person by any means whatsoever. I do my research and I do this type of treatment because I've read the reports and I've read the journal articles and I know the statistics. And I think if they get rid of these therapies, you know, they're going to make it more difficult for people to... I mean, I met people up in the vitamin C clinic last week who've flown over from Scotland to get this treatment because they can't get it in the UK either. I mean, this doesn't do any harm to anybody. Vitamin C infusions, you know, it's a multivitamin. It's a supplement. It's not going to do you any harm. So I don't understand why they want to rule out these things.
Can I ask you about your diet as well, Vicky? Have you changed how you're eating at all?
I have, yeah. So I follow a fairly... plant-based diet now at this stage. So I have two juices a day. My poor husband, God love him, that's his full-time job now at the moment, is keeping me healthy and driving me to all my appointments. So I have a juice in the morning and I have a juice at night, and it's rotten stuff, to be honest. but, you know, I drink it because I think, well, I'll do anything, to be honest, at this stage to keep tumours from spreading. So it's basically made up of spinach, beetroot, celery, and then we put in a bit of blueberries and pineapple to sweeten it up. I was having kale in the juice because that's supposed to be great for cancer as well, but I went to see a healer in Wicklow, actually, up in Ockham, who told me that kale doesn't do anything for my energy. So, I mean, I will go anywhere. I'll stand on my head if somebody told me it will cure my cancer. You know, I mean, when you're put in a position like mine, where you've been given a terminal diagnosis and you've got two young kids, believe me, you will try anything to try and cure it.
Yeah, and just going back to what you said about the people thinking that you people are being preyed on who are vulnerable. I mean, you're kind of the opposite to that. And what you're saying is, if I want to pursue all these different things, I shouldn't be getting judgment from other people about what I'm doing. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, allow people to have the choice, you know, to make that choice themselves. You know, these people are not advertising. You know, they're not, taking people's money. You know, people find out about them through word of mouth, and that's how they find out about these places. I mean, that, you know, I found out about this place because I have cancer, and I've met other people who have had terminal cancer, and they said, oh, you must try this or you try that. And you know, it's up to you then to make the choice whether you want to go or not. You know, it's not like these people are, you know, advertising on the television and saying, you know, I can cure cancer. That's not what they're saying at all. It's a service that's there, the same as anything else. And we're consumers, you know, so we should be allowed to make that choice for ourselves.
Yeah, going back to cervical check, it's funny, around a month ago I'm very bad. I'm not like you. You're kind of one of these people who really looked after your health, which is kind of ironic when I'm reading about your story. You went and did all the right things all the time. I'm terrible, I didn't do that, but recently I started to feel a bit guilty, so I went and got a smear after I hadn't had one for a long time. And it's funny, in the doctor's surgery, the doctor was actually saying to me, this is a month ago, you know, they'll send this off now to America, this will be and I was really surprised by it. And she, the doctor I was dealing with, she was like, yeah, I don't know, what it's not good. And she wasn't happy with it either. And then the week of your story, I had my letter, it's sitting on the windowsill, and I didn't even want to open it. I knew it was from them, and I did open it, and it said no abnormalities. But like many women around the country, you know, you're kind of thinking, well, can I believe what I read? But what you've been very good about is saying to people, still go to your smear, get your smear test done, don't let this put you off, because that's really important, isn't it?
It is, absolutely, Roisin. And I really can't overemphasize that fact, because look, I mean, we see what happens if there is a scandal and people stop using, you know, particular services or stop doing something. You know, the numbers start to go back up. You know what I mean? And that's what I do not want happening. You know, cervical cancer is not curable, not at the moment. You know, if somebody doesn't go for smears and they get an invasive cervical cancer, you know, that's it. You know, this, you're going to be in my position. And I really, you know, I really can't emphasize this enough. You do not want to be in my position. It's not a nice place to be. I'm doing well at the moment because I'm doing all of this. And I do believe that I'm going to survive it, to be honest, because I'm so stubborn. I think that will stand to me. But I have seen women with terminal cervical cancer, and believe, you know, it's an awful death. It really is. I mean, and I've heard people, you know, talk to me about, you know, friends who've died from it, and women, husbands who talked to me about their wives. I mean, there was an article in the newspaper yesterday about another young woman who died, and it's horrendous. You know, the pain, you know, the pain is horrendous, you know, that you get with cervical cancer when it gets really bad and when it goes deep. And, you know, no amount of painkillers is going to take that pain away. And the side effects are horrendous, apart from, you know, all of the pain. You know, you go into early menopause, you put on weight, obviously, and bloating, which no woman wants, obviously. And, you know, initially your hair won't fall out depending on the treatment you're having. But if you get advanced cervical cancer and you have to go on the palliative chemotherapy, you know, you lose everything. You lose your hair. You're sick. And, you know, the other side of it, and I've spoken about this already, and people don't, you know, speak about this enough, is, you know, your whole sense of being a woman because of where you have your cancer is gone. I mean, I don't have a sex life anymore. I haven't had a sex life for 3 years. And, you know, no amount of money and no amount of therapy can cure that, because, you know, it's like literally, you know, we tried to have sex a few times, Roisin, and it's like having literally a red-hot poker up inside you. That's the only way I can describe it, because from all the radiation that I've had, you know, the last three sessions of radiation that I had is called brachytherapy. You know, they put this applicator up inside your vagina. You get knocked out for it. I had three epidurals in the space of a week and a half. and had these applicators, you know, inserted up inside me, and literally they radiate whatever is left. So, I mean, I remember the oncologist saying afterwards, literally, you know, everything's melted together in your insides. You know, you've no ovaries, you've no womb, everything is gone, you know. So, I mean, cervical cancer is an absolutely horrendous cancer to get. So that is why I am encouraging women to still go for smears. I may not have any faith or trust in the current cervical screening program and the way it's managed, but I really, really would not like to see women start going for their smears.
Okay, and thank you very much for talking so honestly and I suppose graphically about it, because maybe we need to hear that, because to be honest, I'd never heard that before. I didn't know that's what it was, and you know, we need to be factual about these things and really name it.
I think so. I mean, I was very reluctant in the beginning to talk about things like that, but I think it's the only way people will listen, to be honest, Roisin, because I mean, I wasn't told when I was diagnosed with cervical cancer that, you know, you may not have a sex life again, or your vagina will actually shorten and shrink, or that, you know, after treatment, you're going to have to use these plastic things called dilators. They're like a very hard vibrator or dildo, whatever you want to call it. And they want you to use these dilators in order to keep your vagina open for internal exams. And also if you want to even think about having a sex life again. I mean, you know, this is horrendous stuff. And there's no, there's very, very little support there for women. I mean, the nurse mentioned when I finished my treatment about going for, you know, to see a psychosexual counsellor. But I had to pay for it myself, and it was crazy money. And at the time, I couldn't afford it first time around when I had cancer. I mean, it's terrible.
Vicky, I'm going to let you go now because I know that you need to go and spend the rest of your day just minding yourself, being with your family and all of that. But today in The Examiner, Alison O'Connor has written about you, and I'd just like to read you out the last few paragraphs of the article, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So she says, but Vicky Phelan chose to fight for herself and the other women who were left in the dark about their abnormal smears, and indeed for all Irish women who have attended the cervical check screening programme. In recent days, the politicians have been making all the right noises about fixing and checking and monitoring and making it illegal for medical personnel not to report an error when it occurs. There was even a resignation, that of the medical director of Cervical Check, Dr. Gráinne Flannery, a thing that is as rare as hen's teeth in Irish public life. We could indulge in mega analysis of Irish society's issues when attempting to deal with matters that relate to below the Irish female belly button. We could say that it was just a coincidence that it was the Cervical Check programme involved here, which exclusively deals with women. But we could also put it in the context of the painful history over decades and the bitter lessons learned from the litany that make up this column. Putting it another way, can we name any medical or social scandal that has affected only the male gender? Last on that lengthening list of shame is the 170,000 or so Irish women who've had to travel since 1980, mainly to the UK, to terminate their pregnancies. Then there are the 2,000 or so who take the abortion pill here every year, with the numbers rising in the secrecy of their bedrooms, terrified that anything will go wrong and they will require medical attention and face possible prosecution. If anything good is to come out of all these various horror stories perpetuated against Irish women, it is the fact that they have re-emerged in their various ways during our national discussion on abortion. Surely the sum of all their parts add up to a really stellar argument on the need for Irish women to be given autonomy over their healthcare choices and to be allowed to have an abortion in their own country. Now, I don't know where you stand on that, but that's just one response from one woman.
I stand on the yes side, because I totally, I was just going to say, it's like what I said earlier about having the choice to have to decide whether you want to have alternative therapies. I totally, 100%, I never had to question whether I was going to vote yes or no. I knew I was going to vote yes. Women should have choices to make those decisions about their bodies themselves and not to have anybody else telling them what to do.
Well, on behalf of, I know a lot of women here in the Irish Times as well, thank you very much for everything you've done, and I know that you'll continue to do more. We'll be thinking of you all the time. I hope you'll come back and talk to us and tell us how you're getting on. You've called for a public inquiry, but one that will be held like in public and not be secret. Mm-hmm. That's important to you, isn't it?
That's very important to me. Now, as I said to you earlier on, I'm not a legal person, and I do know there is a distinction between inquiries and investigations and, all of these things. But what I do not want to see is a closed door where this thing is done in private. Everything, there's too much has been covered up as it is. This needs to be public. If that means that we need to change the legislation to allow for that, well, I think it's warranted at this stage because this is a national scandal. So maybe that's what needs to happen. But I do not want this to be carried out in private and for it to go away like everything else over the last number of years. Because that is my big worry, that if this goes into a inquiry or a tribunal, that nobody will be allowed to report on it, and that conveniently in 2 or 3 years' time people will forget all about it.
Okay, well, I don't think you're going to let that happen, or everyone else isn't going to let that happen.
No.
And we just want to pass on our best wishes to Jim and to Amelia and to Dara, your son as well, and to you. And again, once again, to say thank you on behalf of all the women of Ireland who, you know, are not in the dark anymore about these things and will be much more vigilant thanks to you. And we really appreciate it. So, Vicky Phelan, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Roisin. Thanks a million. Thanks for having me.
That was Vicky Phelan there, and thank you very much to her. And she is inspirational, and she is brave, and she is all those things, but she's also just a very impressive woman, and we're all very grateful to her. But that's all we have time for this week. As she said, smears are really important, and she's shone a light on them in a way that nothing else have. So just to let you know that the cervical screening helpline is 1800 45 45 55. And as Vicky said herself, don't let her story put any woman off going for the tests. Today's podcast was produced by Jennifer Ryan. I'm Roisin Ingle, and I'll talk to you next time.